and leveled the weeds growing rank around the stone boundary fence. He tied up the tomato vines in the flower gardens. And all the time he worked, he marveled at Lucy's changed attitude toward him. He had never been so happy in his life. Later, when they sat alone in the parlor, Lucy sewed a button on his shirt and skillfully mended a torn place. As she stitched fast and deftly, she said wistfully, "The thing we miss the most on Sundays is never hearing a church bell. My people are Methodists, but most of the churches have been destroyed and the ministers scattered. Riley's Chapel, 2 miles south of town, has been torn down. The big church at Park Hill burned 2 years ago. As long as our army occupied the country, we usually had preaching of some kind. Colonel Wadey used to send Mr. Slover, his chaplain, across the river horseback to preach to us in private homes on Sunday nights. But now it's too dangerous." Jeff told her about the Rock Mission House at Sugar Mound back in Linn County, and how it was nearly a 2-hour drive in the buckboard to the mission from the Bussy homestead, and about his family and about the Missouri bushwhackers stealing the family horses from Bess and Mary and trying to kill his father, and of his ambition someday to attend the new state university that would be built in Kansas when the war was over. Lucy took up her knitting and described the seminary at Cane Hill, what she studied, what the school was like. She seemed lonely and anxious to talk. For the first time, he felt he was really beginning to know her. Across the room, Lucy's knitting needles clicked busily. Her eyes on the brown worsted stocking her fingers were fashioning. "At the Cherokee Female Seminary, where my sisters went to school, the students worshipped at the Sehon Chapel, a half-mile east of the seminary." "Curious," Jeff said. "What happened to it?" With a graceful movement, Lucy spread her hands resignedly. "It's deserted now. We heard that some guerrillas stayed there earlier in the war." Her eyes lighted up. "Would you like to see it? It's just over the hill. I haven't been there for 2 years." Her eyes glistened with anticipation. She looked like a girl who liked to go places and do things. Probably with scores of rebel beau following her, Jeff thought. She looked at him challengingly and said, "Maybe Purse will let us borrow her rig." The negress's vehicle, drawn by an old blind mule, was an ancient cart with one buggy wheel and one plow wheel and a quilt-covered box for a seat. Laughing at the novel transportation, Jeff and Lucy sat together on the box. It was great fun. Jeff drove. Dixie explored the brush on each side of the narrow, rocky road that zigzagged through the hills. Overgrown with bluestem and protruding dogwood, the road obviously had not been used for some time. The old cart rattled and creaked as it rolled down gullies and over washed-out sections, listing frightfully as they passed over a root or stump. Finally, the bony mule pulled the squeaking cart into a small clearing and halted. On top of a green knoll nearby, Jeff saw the old chapel, standing in lonely solitude. It was a small church built of red brick. Most of its stained blue window glass had been broken out. Jeff decided that while it would have looked well in any spot, here it was beautiful. A small grove of black locusts grew around it. From the ruins of an outdoor arbor nearby, the intoxicating smell of wild pink azalea was on the air. Jeff helped Lucy from the cart and tried to imagine what the chapel had looked like before the war had scattered its communicants and hastened its ruin. "There's a gallery inside where the colored people worshipped. Most of them were slaves of the congregation," Lucy explained. She glanced upward at the belfry where the bronze-surfaced bell was still visible. "They rang it to summon the seminary students. Many Tahlequah people attended services here. Lee and I used to come often together." Her low voice had grown quiet, almost hushed. Finally, they turned back toward the cart. And so the day they had spent so pleasantly together flashed by like a meteor, and like a meteor would be gone forever. The simple dinner, the talk, the ride in the old cart. With a war going on, he had so little time. It wasn't right. A fellow who might get shot tomorrow shouldn't have to wait a whole year to call a girl by her first name or tell her that he loved her. Silently, he helped her into the rickety cart and turned the old mule homeward. Lucy was very quiet. They started back to Telequa, the wheels turning silently as they passed over sandy spots. The sun sank low, throwing long black shadows across the road. Jeff was busy piloting the mule around the rough spots. As he drove, he was thinking. Thinking that he wouldn't see Lucy Washburn again for a long, long time. Might not ever see her again if the rebels began shooting straighter. He figured he had stretched his luck about as thin as it would go. He knew Blunt's carpenters had almost finished the log rafts they were building to ferry the infantry and the artillery across the river. The new campaign against Cooper would probably start tomorrow. It was almost dusk. When he saw the lighted windows of the Washburn home, his heart fell. He wished it was 1,000 miles away so he could prolong his ride with Lucy. He looked at Dixie trotting alongside the cart, her nose sniffing out the grass ahead. He said, "Ma'am, I have a favor to ask. Now that I'm in the cavalry, it's hard for me to keep my dog. Would you want to keep her for me until I get back? You'd find her an excellent guard around the house." Lucy said quietly, "I'd like to keep her." "Thank you, ma'am." As they approached the house, the Dunn heard the old cart's axles creaking. Raising his head, he looked at them and nickered softly. Jeff stopped the cart by the gate and, climbing out, walked around behind it to help Lucy out. He didn't want to go back to the camp on the Illinois or anywhere else. He didn't want to go back to war. Lucy stood and put her hands on Jeff's shoulders. As he lifted her lightly to the ground, she looked at him. Her eyes softened as she read the dejection in his face. Passing her left arm around Jeff's neck and rising on her toes, she kissed him, gently on the mouth. Looking up at him with quiet amusement, she said in her low, drawling speech, "I like you, Jeff Bussy. But I warn you, I haven't changed my mind about the war. I'm still a rebel, to the backbone." But she smiled when she dropped her arms. Jeff was thunderstruck. You could have knocked him over with a feather. Lucy Washburn had kissed him. Shaken clear to his toes, he could still feel the pressure of her cool lips on his. He knew he would never forget it as long as he lived. Later, when Jeff untied and mounted the Dunn, Lucy sat on the wooden stile in the twilight, her arm around Dixie's neck. Behind them, the Washburn home was etched blackly against the red sunset. Dixie started to get up and follow Jeff. "No, no. You stay here," Jeff told the dog gently. Puzzled, she sank back obediently on her haunches. Both the girl and the dog watched him until he rode out of sight. Next morning, Jeff awoke early. The morning gun crashed noisily, echoing against the neighboring hills and rumbling and reverberating across the distant flats, but Jeff didn't hear it. The starry new flag Blunt had brought from Fort Scott was run to the top of the mast and, unfurling slowly and gracefully in the morning breeze, caught the rays of the rising sun. But Jeff didn't see it. His mind was too busy reliving his day with Lucy. Lucy was all he could think about until he ran into David Gardner on the picket line. An expression of urgency on his florid face, David led him off to one side, out of earshot. "Jeff, are you going out again today with the scouts?" "I don't know. They haven't told us yet." The big orange freckles on David's face and neck seemed to pale. "Gosh almighty, Jeff, don't you dare ride anywhere near the Wadey outfit."
"Why?"
David's eyes blinked with fear.
"We went swimming again last night with the rebel pickets. They know all about Clardy having Lee Washburn shot. The whole rebel army is sore about it. Their picket said the waiting men have sworn that the first Clardy man they capture behind their lines will go before a firing squad before he can say God with his mouth open.
Jeff felt that cold, flat statement clear down to the toes of his boots. He was the only Clardy man in Blunt's scouts, now that Noah had been put back in the cavalry to improve his horsemanship. David cocked his head in a listening attitude.
Hear them hammers going? Blunt's flatboats is nearly done. We hear there'll probably be a big battle tomorrow or next day. Maybe they won't need to send out the scouts.
Jeff swallowed uneasily. He had never heard of an attacking army that didn't send out scouts. After watering and feeding the dun, he returned to his quarters.
Bussy!
Jeff froze. Just as he feared, it was the orderly sergeant summoning him to an emergency meeting with Orff and the scout patrol. First, the sergeant took them to the ordnance department where they exchanged their blue uniforms for ragged butternut attire, careful to divest themselves of any article that might identify them with the Union cause. Then Orff led them to a vacant room in the fort where they wouldn't be overheard. His pipe in one hand and a sulfur match in the other, Orff explained their mission.
The general wants to know if the rebel General Steele is bringing reinforcements up from Texas to join Cooper. Soon as it gets dark, we're to cross the river, ride in behind the reb lines and mixing with the reb civilians, teamsters, anybody we run into there, try to find out when Steele is expected and how many men he's got.
Jeff squirmed nervously. It didn't sound a bit good to him. Orff dragged the red tip of the match across the seat of his corduroy pants and, holding the tiny flame in midair, gave them a level look.
I don't have to tell you that this patrol is on probation. We didn't do so good 2 days ago. If it hadn't been for that haversack Bussy got, we'd have been blanked. The general's watching us close this time. Let's don't bumble it.
Frowning, he touched the flame to the bowl of his pipe. Throwing his match away, he blew a puff of gray tobacco smoke toward the ceiling.
We're to split up in pairs. This is Monday. If everything goes well, the general says he'll start moving down the Texas Road Tuesday. He says soon as we get the information he wants, we are to hit the Texas Road and identify ourselves to the Union pickets, who will be told in advance to expect us. They'll take us back to Blunt.
They started at midnight. There was a full moon. This time they went west instead of east. Avoiding the fords again, they swam the Arkansas 6 miles west of the fort. Although the river was falling, Jeff gasped once as the water rose to his knees and spilled into his boots when the dun stepped into a deep hole and had to swim. But they got across safely. On the rebel side, Orff divided the patrol into pairs. With a brief handshake, they separated, riding in different directions. Jeff's companion was Jim Bostwick, a big, easygoing Missourian who drank black coffee by the quart, and now that he was to be absent for 2 or 3 days, filled his canteen with it to the brim. Bostwick had been a Union scout for General Curtis ahead of the Battle of Pea Ridge.
"Better let Bostwick do the talking if you get in a jam," Orff suggested.
That was all right with Jeff. As Bostwick and Jeff rode through the moonlit countryside, they were careful to skirt roads where rebel sentries might challenge them. They wanted to avoid all contact with enemy military forces if they could. But that was not to be. 2 hours before daybreak, they splashed across a small creek and, wading out upon the opposite bank, ran squarely into several dark figures.
"Halt, or we'll fire!"
a thin, high-pitched voice snarled. Jeff felt a strong hand grab the dun's reins. A pistol was thrust into his face. A hammer clicked.
"Who are y'all? Where you going?"
the same voice demanded, coldly and menacingly. Drawing a long breath, Jeff fought to get control of himself. Bostwick said boldly,
"Hold your fire. We just want to get through to Honey Springs."
He spoke easily, and with a tolerant good humor natural to him. In the moonlight, Jeff saw they were now surrounded by rebel sentries, 40 or 50 hobbled horses were night grazing close by. Near them, using their saddles for pillows, the ground was black with men sleeping. Jeff could hear their snores.
"Lots of people in that fix. Why you all want to go to Honey Springs?"
"We're on our way there to join Wadey's outfit," Bostwick lied glibly.
Jeff felt his breathing quicken. Bostwick was certainly laying it on thick. Jeff hoped the explanation was satisfactory, because there was no hope of escaping now. Apparently they had blundered onto a large detachment of rebel cavalry.
"If that's all you want, then you can climb down off your horses. Colonel Wadey and his outfit is camped right here."
Chapter 19. Wrong Side of the River. Wadey men. Jeff's heart leaped so violently it almost jumped out of his shirt. Cold sweat beaded on his forehead. Bostwick wasn't a Clardy man, but Jeff was. Already he could feel the execution blindfold tightening around his eyes. There was nothing to do but dismount and unsaddle. Surly voice gave them each a short stake rope, and they tethered their horses to small saplings nearby.
"You can sleep here till morning," he rasped commandingly. "Then maybe the colonel or the recruiting officer will talk to you, or maybe they won't."
With a gesture of mingled hostility and contempt, his arm indicated an unoccupied grassy spot. Pillowing their heads on their saddles, they lay down in their clothes. The grass was wet with dew, but Jeff was too worried to notice or care. It felt good to lie still and relax. He was dog-tired. But he couldn't sleep. Surly voice lay between him and Bostwick. Even if he devised a plan of escape, there would be no way to tell Bostwick. And if he got away and Bostwick didn't, things might go hard with the Missourian. Maybe they'd learn more pretending to join the Wadey cavalry than they would consorting with rebel civilians in the rear. Why not play along until they found out what Blunt wanted to know? The main risk was talking their way past Wadey or his recruiting officer in the morning. But that seemed a much better gamble than trying to shoot their way out of an armed camp tonight. The more Jeff thought about it, the better he liked it. Turning on his side, he closed his eyes and fell asleep almost instantly. He was awakened just after daybreak by somebody stamping the ground near his head. The stamping was accompanied by an odd jingling noise. Opening his eyes, he saw somebody's boots. On the heel of each boot was a large rusty spur with a drag rowel. Jeff dodged back and recoiled in fright. Over him hovered an old man, ugly as a gargoyle. He was heavily built and bareheaded. In the early morning light, the man's head was almost twice as large as that of a normal human being. His huge, misshapen nose was pockmarked. His little round ears were cauliflowered and looked as though they had been screwed forcibly into his head. His eyes were unsightly little slits that peeped out cunningly from beneath the most beetling brows Jeff had ever seen. When the man saw Jeff looking at him, his face broke into such a hideous grin that Jeff thought quickly about the pistol in his belt. But the man seemed to want to be friendly.
"Wake up, boys, day's a-breakin', beans in the pot, sourdough's a-bakin',"
he mumbled in a weird, tuneless key. His voice was broken and had a low, whining quality. He sounded as if he were about to break into tears. The man walked off, awakening others with his novel method of stamping almost in their faces. Jeff sat up. A lemon flush of daylight lay across the eastern horizon. The robins had just awakened. In the pale hush of dawn, he smelled smoke and heard something bubbling in a pot. It was light enough to distinguish objects. Scores of baggage wagons were parked ghost-like, with their tongues up, and hundreds of horses grazed near them. Gasping with surprise, he realized this was no rebel patrol. This was the main body of the enemy force. Something big, some major enemy movement, was in the air. Other figures were sitting up, yawning and stretching, throwing off brown and gray horse blankets. Jeff looked for Surly Voice. He was gone. He towed Boswick into wakefulness.
"What are we going to tell them when they ask us where we're from?"
he whispered.
"Y'all can eat with our mess here," growled Surly voice, coming up suddenly behind them.
Startled, they spun round, staring guiltily. He was a thin, red-haired, consumptive-looking fellow, with hard, blue eyes. Jeff estimated him to be about 25 years old. He wore a medium-brimmed slouch hat, on the sleeve of his faded gray uniform shirt with the yellow stripes of a sergeant. He glared at them with open suspicion and gestured arrogantly toward the fire. It was plain he considered them prisoners until they established their identity. At the fire, the repulsive-looking old man, who apparently was the cook, was broiling pieces of beef on a hickory spit and baking sweet potatoes in the coals. The bubbling noise came from a large fire-blackened can of coffee. While they helped themselves with their fingers to chunks of the delicious hot beef, Jeff had his first look at the weighty men. They were the roughest, raggedest troops he had ever seen. Most of them were dressed in tattered homespun gray or dingy yellowish-brown butternut. But they had tough, shrewd faces and looked as though they could obey an order or fight intelligently without one if they had to. Despite their Cherokee blood, most of them looked more white than Indian. Jeff stared with nervous fascination at their weapons. There wasn't a saber in the whole outfit. Instead, each man wore a broad, straight, double-edged bowie knife in his belt. Their rude bayonets seemed to have been made by local blacksmiths from saws, butcher knives, and files. Surly Voice, whom the others called familiarly Sam or Fields, had serrated the edges of his knife so it could tear Yankee flesh. They sat around on their heels, drinking tin cups of hot coffee and smoking shuck cigarettes. Jeff could tell from their conversation that they were getting ready to go into battle. As the men wolfed down the beef and the sweet potatoes, they called the cook Heifer and openly insulted him about everything from his food to his deformed face. The old man took the rough banter good-naturedly. Jeff saw that the nickname Heifer was appropriate. The shape of the cook's head was not greatly unlike that of a full-grown female calf. But his food was clean and tasty, and Jeff bit hungrily into his third chunk of hot beef.
"How'd you expect me to fight after eating this tripe?" "Heifer, you're going to have to cut down on the sody in these biscuits. I'm getting plum yaller,"
a gaunt blonde fellow growled amiably. The remark drew a general laugh. Obviously, there were no biscuits.
"You always was, yaller. Don't blame the biscuits,"
Heifer retorted in his sobbing, hysterical speech, and everybody roared and slapped the blonde fellow sympathetically on the back.
"Got you that time, Ben,"
somebody said, and they all laughed again. Jeff thought they were the gayest, most light-hearted troops he had ever seen. They didn't act like men going into battle. They seemed more like cattle herders getting ready to do a long day's work on the range. Still dreading his ordeal before Wadey, Jeff wondered where the rebel cavalry leader was and what he looked like. Where he had seen only 50 men last night, there were hundreds this morning, all of them eating their breakfasts over small campfires and saddling their mounts. The cook saw Jeff had no cup. Grinning, he handed him half a canteen that looked as if it had been blown in two with powder. Jeff saw with surprise that it was a Union canteen. The weighty men had few canteens. Instead, they carried clay jugs, straw-colored bottles, or just plain tin cups. He dipped the crude vessel full of coffee from the big can on the fire. Jeff nearly gagged on his first swallow of the foul-tasting concoction. It was all he could do to keep from spitting it out upon the grass in front of everybody. This was his first introduction to rebel coffee, made by pouring cornmeal in a skillet, stirring it until it parched brownly and evenly, then spooning it in a pot and pouring boiling water over it. Jeff looked at Boswick across the fire from him and froze with alarm. Chatting in friendly fashion with the rebels around him, the Missourian was boldly drinking the cold Fort Gibson coffee he had brought along in his canteen. Nobody in the South had coffee like that. If the rebels caught a whiff of that authentic northern beverage, they would know certainly that both Jeff and Boswick were spies. Well, they'd know it soon enough anyhow.
Any minute now, they would have to face Wadey, and they still didn't have a story made up. Fields, the hostile sergeant, bulged in Jeff's path, glaring sourly down at him.
Let's go and see the colonel.
Silently, Jeff and Bostwick followed him. He led them to a wagon in the middle of the camp and up to a handsome man who wore his long, sweeping black hair down the back of his neck. It stuck out underneath his slouch hat. Clad in open shirt and butternut pants, he was busily stuffing some papers into a haversack. Behind him, draped over a wagon wheel, was a gray uniform coat with a major's insignia upon the collar.
Morning, Will. Where's the colonel?
Fields greeted without saluting. With pounding pulse, Jeff realized this wasn't Wadey.
Left an hour ago for a staff meeting with Cooper. What you got there, Sam? Couple of deserters?
The major's resonant, far-carrying voice sounded more jolly than threatening.
Meh. Couple fighters, at least. That's what they claim. Came in about 3 this morning. Said they wanted to join Wadey.
He looked scornfully at Jeff and Bostwick and scowled at the major, as though reminding him that he expected him to do his duty. The long-haired major turned his intelligent brown eyes fully upon them, and Jeff could tell from the color of his skin that he was part Cherokee, too. He was obviously in a hurry.
How come you all want to join us?
He asked seriously, looking keenly from one to the other. Remembering Orff's instructions, Jeff decided to let Bostwick do the talking. But the major wasn't looking at Bostwick. He was looking directly at Jeff. Jeff's mind worked fast. For the first time in months, his stomach felt satisfyingly full. He grinned.
Sir, we like the grub better here.
Better here than where?
Frightened stiff, Jeff turned his grin on wider.
Better here than anywhere, sir.
The rebel major scrutinized Jeff from the top of his tousled brown hair to the soles of his dusty boots. He saw nothing but a boy, a pleasant-faced, clean-cut boy who looked a little scared. His face softening, he took his coat off the wagon wheel and put it on, and suddenly Jeff had the feeling that everything was going to be all right. The early morning sun peaked suddenly over the oak-covered eastern ridge, stabbing the scene with long streamers of golden light. Now the parked baggage wagons didn't look quite so spectral. Jeff saw the initials CSA stenciled in white on their sides.
"What's your name?" the major asked.
"Jefferson Davis Bussey, sir," answered Jeff.
Then he caught his breath. He had given his right name. It had never occurred to him that he might need another in enemy country. A surprised expression came into the major's eyes. Despite his rank, he wasn't accustomed to being addressed as sir. He liked the boy's politeness. He began hurriedly to button his uniform coat and turned apologetically to Fields.
"Oh, bosh, Sam, with a name like that, he must be all right. You swear, man. I was supposed to meet the colonel at brigade headquarters 5 minutes ago."
Snatching a high-pommeled saddle off the ground, he carried it, stirrups dragging and cinch rings and spurs tinkling musically, to his black horse staked nearby. The hostile sergeant had no choice but to swear them into Company H of the Cherokee Mounted Rifles. Slowly and laboriously, he wrote their names on the company roll. With his quill, he pointed at Bostwick, who had also given his correct name.
"What's your full moniker, Robert E. Lee Bostwick?" he growled insolently.
Later, Jeff learned that the major was William P. Adair, a lawyer who lived on Grand River and was one of Wadey's most highly trusted officers and personal friends. Quickly, the irritable sergeant lined everybody up and called the roll. Jeff was amused at some of the Indian names in his unit. Beamer, Dreadful Water, Duck, Doghead, Hog Toter. The sergeant rattled them off glibly, ending up with the 3 oddest names of all: Kickup, Turnover, and Roundabout. Jeff also noticed that every man on the roll was present and accounted for. It was the stamp of a good outfit. Apparently, the Wadey forces had lost nobody because of desertion. Later, a lieutenant began dispatching guard patrols in all directions. As Jeff rode out with his, he asked the man next to him about the cook.
"Who?"
"Heifer. He's a loner.
Sleeps outdoors on the ground, even in winter. Says sleeping inside smothers him. Everybody likes him, but nobody wants to be close pals with him. It's the way he talks and the way he looks, I guess. Heifer's so ugly that the flies won't light on him. They say he had a son of his own once, a handsome-looking boy. Heifer worked hard to get money to send the boy back east to school, but the boy was ashamed of his pa's ugliness. Never came back home or had anything to do with Heifer afterward. Heifer hails from Texas. Used to cook for some big cattle spreads there. The patrol dropped Jeff off near a weather-beaten church. Alongside it was a small graveyard whose wooden monuments, gray with age, leaned crazily this way and that. All around, like somber guards, stood several old oaks. It was quiet and peaceful. After staking out the dun, he lay on his back in the graveyard grass, worrying about the battle to be fought the next day. Would he be ordered to fire upon his own troops while riding with the forces of the South? He resolved not to fire directly at his comrades. Above him in one of the big oaks, a mockingbird was splitting his throat. As he sang, he threw himself angrily into the blue sky, wings fluttering, then stood suddenly on his head in the air and flew back down to the same branch, scolding and fussing. Jeff wondered idly what the bird was upset about. It was hot. For want of anything better to do, he read the inscription carved on the wooden face of the monument nearest him. It said, Sarah McDivitt, born June 2, 1788, died November 6, 1854. There was a verse under it, too, a wistful little verse that seemed to express all humanity's sad yearning not to be forgotten completely after death. Jeff got up on his knees so he could read it better. It said, As you are, so once was I. As I am, you soon will be. When these words you see, remember me. Jeff wondered who Sarah McDivitt was and how old she had been when she chose the pensive lines for her gravestone. The church reminded him of the deserted chapel he and Lucy had visited 2 days before. With a stab of longing, he thought of her, and then of her abrupt, I like you, Jeff Bussey, but I warn you, I'm still a rebel, to the backbone. He wished the war would be over tomorrow. Several hours passed. He was so sleepy that he almost dozed off. Finally, he heard something coming down the road. It was a husky young Negro driving a small herd of red cows ahead of him. They moved very slowly, the cows grazing as they walked. Howdy, Jeff said as they passed in front of him. Startled, the Negro boy jumped. Then he saw Jeff and looked with wonder at his horse and at the pistol in his belt.
You a soldier?
Jeff nodded.
Why do they always build their graveyards next to the churches in this country? He asked.
The Negro boy looked solemn. He was wearing a gray homespun shirt, striped trousers, and had a sweat rag tied around his bare head. He was barefoot. Jeff wondered how he could stand walking on the sharp rocks.
So the dead folks can hear the organ music and the singing on Sundays, I reckon, he said simply.
Jeff stood and pointed to the church.
What's the name of it?
Hancock Mission, replied the Negro, slowly and proudly. They built it 15 years before I was born. They sure did do something when they built it. Stands there in the woods a-pointin' its spire up towards heaven. Every time I passes it, I feels kind of reverent-like. I always sing something religious when I drives the cows by.
Have you ever been in it?
No, sir. It's just for white folks and Indians.
They fell silent. A warm wind gently stirred the long graveyard grass. A flock of green parakeets circled a nearby field with shrill cries searching for cocklebirds. The old church dozed peacefully in the warm sunlight.
You're a big, strong-looking fella. Why aren't you in the Southern Army? Jeff asked.
The Negro boy looked at him strangely.
The South don't want slaves in their armies, he said.
He added proudly,
We's too valuable. We's property.
Jeff's mouth fell open. He hadn't realized that. Are you a slave?
The Negro nodded soberly. He looked at Jeff with narrowing eyes.
How come you never knowed slaves can't get in the army? Where are you from?
Kansas, said Jeff boldly. He decided that if the rebels ever did question him at length, it would be safer giving his own name and home than trying to fabricate false ones.
Isn't that where Mr. Abraham Lincoln lives?
No, he was born in Illinois. But now that he's president, he lives in Washington. Why? What do you know about Lincoln?
The Negro boy smiled, and a rapturous look came into his dark eyes.
I know more about him than anybody. All the slaves talks about him all the time. We loves our masters, but we all want to be free someday.
He spoke so guilelessly that Jeff was impressed. It was an odd speech for anybody to make in rebel-held country. He supposed the community was so isolated that no military force had ever passed through it before. Jeff picked up a small rock and tossed it at a nearby gravestone.
If you were at Fort Gibson, you'd be free right now. In the Northern Army, there's a battalion of Negro soldiers from Kansas. They're all free. They wear blue uniforms just like the white soldiers, and they're good fighters, too.
An eager light came into the young Negro's eyes.
I've been to Fort Gibson. I know's a short way to get there without going up the Texas Road. 2 years ago, I helped drive a herd of cows to Fort Gibson for my master. While we was there, I saw one of them big cannon guns. How far will one of them things shoot?
Oh, if it's big enough. About 2 miles, I guess.
The Negro rolled his eyes in awe.
Mm-mm. A man could run all day and still get killed.
Laughing, Jeff brushed the grass off his pants.
What's your name?
Lemon Jones. I belongs to Master Saul Hibbs, a Chickasaw Indian farmer. I lives half a mile down the road there.
Jeff looked at the sun. It was about time for him to be relieved. He mounted the dun and, lifting his hand in farewell to the Negro, jogged off down the road. As he swung along, he thought that if he ever got in trouble, real bad trouble, he might find an ally in Lemon Jones. He bet he could have made Lehman's eyes stick out like marbles if he had told him he had once heard Abraham Lincoln make a speech. At daybreak next morning, Jeff saddled, mounted, and, joining hundreds of hard-faced, weighty riders, rode 20 miles north to Elk Creek, where Cooper's rebel battle line was being formed on both sides of the Texas Road. In the timber north of the creek, they dismounted and, building log barricades, awaited the onslaught of Blunt's Union Army. Jeff could hear cannon fire north of him, and he knew that the Union artillery commanded by Hopkins and Smith had gone to work on the rebel artillery. He couldn't help feeling excited and uneasy. He had never gone to battle under such strange circumstances. Horrified at the possibility of fighting his friends, he had to stay and try to get the information Blunt wanted. Besides, if he left now, it would draw suspicion on Bostwick. Keeping his eyes open, he had a good view of the rebel preparations for the battle. Cooper's army consisted mainly of Texans and Indians. Jeff saw the Texas cavalry riding their little Mustangs into position in the rebel center. They were mostly blonde men, who controlled their mounts with chain bits and thrust their booted feet into big, wooden ox-yoke stirrups. Cooper posted on his left two Creek regiments, commanded by Colonel D.N. McIntosh. His right wing was composed of Wade's 1st and 2nd Cherokee regiments, of which Jeff was now a part. Jeff was most surprised of all when he saw Cooper's reserve, a regiment of Choctaws and Chickasaws. Before he saw them, he could hear the jingling of the little bells and rattles they wore on their arms and in their horses' bridles. Then they appeared through the trees, mounted on their small ponies. Their faces were painted orange and green. Although they looked active and sinewy in their buckskin hunting shirts and leggings, Jeff was amazed to see that their weapons consisted only of obsolete Indian rifles, knives, and tomahawks. They were whooping and yelling shrilly as though to keep up their courage in spite of their incredible lack of firepower.
A crackle of musket fire broke out ahead, and the weighty men began to unsling their weapons, mostly shotguns and one-shot Southern Enfields with brass mountings. In plain hearing of nearly everybody in the detail, Fields, the bossy rebel sergeant, ordered Jeff to the rear.
"You're too young for the front line," he said curtly. "We fight dismounted, with every fourth man holding four horses in the rear. Today you'll stay in the rear and be a horse holder."
He thrust his reins into Jeff's hand.
"Yes, sir," said Jeff, saluting.
He took the reins, secretly pleased that he wouldn't have to oppose his own side in battle. Bostwick wasn't so lucky. The Missourian was drafted for duty on the firing line, but he seemed to be taking it well. As he trudged off to the front, his boots clumping awkwardly in the underbrush, he winked at Jeff and, reaching behind him, patted his canteen, still one half full of cold Union coffee. A shower of rain fell about an hour before the battle began, rendering the rebel powder obtained from Mexico useless. In the damp weather, it became paste-like and would not ignite. Jeff heard some Creek soldiers complaining because even when they built fires, they couldn't dry out their wet musket caps. When the northern bombshells, screeching through the trees overhead, began exploding with a roar, setting the grass and brush afire, it took all of Jeff's strength to hold the four saddled horses he had been entrusted with. Soon, rebel after rebel began to pass him, running from the front. Jeff kept his own eyes and ears open, making cautious inquiries about both Steele's and Cabell's troops. All he could learn was that while both were on their way to the battle, neither had arrived. Blunt's timing had been superb. The firing ahead of him redoubled and seemed to be coming closer. The two weighty regiments were being driven back. Now he could smell the smoke from the black powder. He wrapped the four sets of bridle reins more tightly about one hand. Soon, the rebel Cherokees began to appear, grabbing their reins from the horse holders, mounting and spurring southward away from the battle. Two of them claimed their horses from Jeff.
"Their bombshells shoot twice, over there and over here," one gasped in protest.
"Where's Fields?"
Jeff shouted as they swung into the saddle.
"He's coming yonder,"
they yelled, and rode off, whipping their mounts with a frenzy.
Watching them, Jeff laughed bitterly. Although he was just a horse holder, he aimed to be the best dad-gummed horse holder in the rebel cavalry. He didn't like the sassy sergeant's crack about his youth. Vaulting onto the dun's back, he waited. The figure of a man burst from the trees, crashing through the underbrush and sweetbriar. His shoulder was bleeding and one arm hung limp. His hat was gone, exposing his red hair. It was Fields. Jeff knew the federal troops must be close behind him. Leaning down, Jeff handed him his reins, but the horse was plunging excitedly and, with one arm paralyzed, Fields had trouble mounting. Jeff saw he wasn't going to make it. Federal bullets were bouncing along the ground like tiny frogs around a mill pond. Jeff got off the dun to help, but Fields' horse jerked loose and galloped wildly into the woods. Cursing, the rebel sergeant ran a few stumbling steps in pursuit, then gave up.
"Here, sergeant!" Jeff led the dun up to him. "He'll ride double. I'll boost you into the saddle, then I'll crawl on behind."
Panting hoarsely, Fields stared at Jeff with fierce, pain-glazed eyes, and for a moment Jeff thought he meant to refuse. Then he put one foot in the stirrup and grasped the pommel of the saddle with one hand. Jeff put his shoulder under Fields' rump and shoved him upward. Then he leaped on behind.
"Here, sergeant, you take the reins. I'll need both hands to hang on."
After standing around all morning, the dun wanted to run, even with a double load. It was a wild ride. Legs flopping crazily, Jeff clung with both hands to the cantle of the saddle. With every stride, the sergeant's shoulder wound was irritated, and he alternately cursed and groaned. After they encountered the Texas road, their progress was easier. They began to overtake and pass other weighty men. Soon a horse with an empty saddle was commandeered and Fields put upon it. They kept going. The skies were still cloudy and the air sticky and close. Inside his shirt, Jeff could feel sweat running down his stomach and ribs.
His shirt was torn, and the bare skin low on his right side smarted where the bull briars had clawed him. The weighty men rode silently, shame and discouragement in their faces. Once they stopped at a well to hold a gourd dipper of water to Fields' hot lips and to smear post-oak bark ooze on his wound.
"How do you feel, Sam?" somebody asked.
Fields snarled savagely.
"What do you care how I feel? You all know, doctor. You wouldn't know what to do if I did tell you how I feel."
Doggedly, they resumed their flight. Others had been wounded, too, but there were no doctors to minister to them, either. They just bore the pain and kept riding. They came to a low, sandy spot in the big road. Jeff could see the tall swamp grass and smell the stagnant water. Up ahead, somebody began to curse.
"Gallon nippers!" he yelled,
pulling up his coat collar. Jeff soon found out what gallon nippers were. The salt grass abounded in mosquitoes. When the horses' feet stirred the grass, the insects swarmed on the cavalry, humming ominously. Soft as lace, they alighted on the exposed parts of his body. The men whipped up their horses, ducking their heads and brushing the insects off their faces and necks with their shirt sleeves. All afternoon long, they retreated down the Texas road. The rebel farms they passed were untouched by raiders. The cotton had been hoed neatly and looked abundant, and while it would be 2 weeks yet before the corn would be fair for bread, it was tasseling clean. Grimly, Jeff thought of the violence and terrible destruction the weighty men had wrought on the Union farms farther north. He felt very little compassion for the men with whom he was riding, but he stayed with them because he had a job to do. At mid-afternoon, just below the junction to North Fork Town, they met Cabell's advance. While a halt was called, so the generals could parley, Jeff was careful to count Cabell's forces, more than 2,000 Arkansas cavalry and 4 pieces of artillery. Jeff was surprised to see that so many of the Arkansasoyers were gray-headed men and young boys. Mingling with him, he soon learned that desertion from Cabell's brigade, many of them conscripts of Union sympathy, had been so widespread that the officers had very little control over the situation. Quickly, Cabell joined Cooper in the headlong flight southward. Just before dark, a slow, chilling rain set in. Owning very few slickers, the weighty men had to take it like the cattle in the nearby fields. The road had now become so slippery that they slowed their pace to a walk. Wet to the skin, Jeff was so exhausted that he dozed in the saddle. He discovered that by balancing himself squarely over the horse and kneeling slightly forward, he could sleep while the dun was walking. Once when they were crossing a creek, Hooley Pogue, a wiry, rollicking little Cherokee mixed blood who was sound asleep in the saddle, tumbled off his horse into the water with a loud splash.
"What happened?"
Fields asked irritably. Gasping, and thoroughly awake now, Pogue scrambled to his feet in the knee-deep water.
"Excuse me, Sam," he sputtered. "I thought you said dismount."
A roar of amused laughter arose above the noise of the downpour. It was the first laugh Jeff had heard since the battle.
Again, he marveled at privates and sergeants conversing as equals, addressing each other by their first names. The gray rain sluiced down in long, wind-slanted lines. Jeff could feel it pelting his shoulders and spattering noisily off his hat brim.
"Phew!" somebody called. "It's sure coming down. Sounds like pouring peas on a rawhide."
They had ridden 2 hours in the rainy darkness when they were hailed to a stop between North Fork Town and Perryville by a man standing in the road waving a torch. He wore an old carpet strip for a raincoat. It had a hole in the top for his head.
"Camp's over here," he told them,
pointing his torch to the right. The torch flickered feebly, threatening to go out. As Jeff obediently followed the others, he felt a sudden chill and wished for a warm coat. Then he saw the round bulge of a commissary wagon wheel,
and heard the peculiar sobbing voice of Heifer Hobbs directing the weary men to their tents. They were back at their original camp. The cook had made a rude lamp from a bowl full of sand, thrusting a nail through a rag and then deep into the sand, with the rag emerging at the top. Using oil he had rendered from a fat possum he had killed that afternoon, he poured the possum oil in the sand and onto the rag, then lit the rag and set the lamp on the shelf at the rear of the commissary wagon, out of the rain and wind. The homemade device smelled a little, but Jeff was surprised at its good light. Feeling his way in the blackness, he staked out the dun and gave him a ration of corn from the commissary wagon. He felt ravenously hungry, but figured he would either have to eat cold food or go without. Nobody could cook in this downpour. But again, he reckoned, without the resourcefulness of Heifer. For weeks, the cook had saved all his bacon rinds and axle grease boxes for fires. He also had a few dry tree branches hidden away in his commissary wagon. While Jeff held a blanket over the fire, keeping it alive, Heifer went to work. Quickly, he mixed a great dishpan of cornbread dough, plastering some of it on small boards which he leaned near the fire. He wrapped the remainder in corn shucks and buried them in the hot ashes. Soon he was able to offer the wet, exhausted men hot cornbread and steaming plates of a southern dish Jeff had never tasted before. Irish potatoes and green apples boiled together, mashed and seasoned with salt, pepper, and onions. And there was plenty of hot coffee to wash it down. Nobody joshed or teased the cook tonight. Gratefully, the tired men in Fields' mess scooped up the food with their fingers or their bowie knives as they discussed in hushed tones the battle they had just lost and the comrades who had been killed or wounded. Afterward, Jeff threw the blanket around his shoulders and wondered where Bostwick was. A doctor had ridden up from the rebel hospital at Boggy Depot to treat the wounded. Tents were going up all around. Hogfat lamps were lit, and soon the place began to look and sound more like a military camp. Jeff had pitched in and was helping Heifer clean up when he heard feet sloshing toward them in the dark. The slim figure of the sergeant appeared, his wounded arm in a sling, an oilcloth thrown carelessly over his shoulders in the fashion of a cape. The rain had slackened somewhat, but now the wind had arisen, and the cold seemed to blow right through Jeff's sodden clothing. Fields stood looking accusingly down at Jeff.
"Your pal, Bostwick. He ain't coming back. Shell got him," he reported, his voice low with passion.
Shocked by the bad news, Jeff eyed Fields bleakly in the flickering light that came from Heifer's possum lamp.
"Bostwick dead."
Jeff breathed a silent prayer for the Missourian's soul and waited. There was something sinister in the sergeant's manner. Fields went on.
"He fell close to me. All day long I watched him drink from that canteen of his. I figured it was whiskey. After I got hit, I needed a shot of whiskey. So I took the canteen off his dead body and upped it. You know what I found? Coffee. Yankee coffee. He was a blue belly, and so are you."
Jeff felt a premonition of disaster. He stood facing Fields, grateful for the partial darkness that blotted out the guilty expression he was certain must be on his face. He thought fast. He was on the wrong side of the river. His life might depend on what he said next. Heifer said it for him. The cook straightened over his pots and pans, the firelight playing fitfully over his terribly deformed face. Suddenly he blew his nose into the fire, using his finger and clearing one nostril, then the other, with nasal blasts that rang like a horse snorting.
"Sam, you're addled," he blurted. "What else does the boy have to do today to prove himself to you? Tote you on his back all the way from Honey Springs to Red River?"
Field snarled something unintelligible. Heifer kept talking.
"You ought to get down on your knees and beg his pardon. Where'd you be today if it wasn't for him? I'll tell you where. Walking to a prison camp someplace in Kansas. If this boy's what you say he is, he could have left you on the battlefield and gone on over to Blunt. Or he could have taken you with him to Blunt. You was helpless.
Sam, somebody called from the darkness. Sam Fields, Major Adair wants to see you.
Turning on his heel, Fields stamped off through the mud. He didn't seem convinced. Relief flooded over Jeff like warm sunshine. Gratefully, he thanked the cook. Heifer snorted.
Don't pay no attention to him, he advised, turning toward the fire. When he gets this way, he don't know skunks from house cats. He's a good officer, but he's been all tore up inside ever since the Fed shot his best friend. Boy named Lee Washburn, before firing squad. That made Fields crazy suspicious of everybody. Now he can't wait to catch some Fed scout behind our lines, and if he ever does, God help him. He'd cut him to pieces with his bowie.
Jeff remembered the jagged edges of Fields' knife. So Fields knew Lee Washburn. No wonder Fields was suspicious of anybody who drank Yankee coffee. Wet, cold, and miserable, Jeff looked around for a place to sleep. He didn't even have a quilt. Soaked to the skin, he felt weak and flushed and feverish. He looked longingly at the tents close by, revealed by the lightning flashes. Nobody had asked him to share one, and he hadn't slept much the last two nights. He was so tired he didn't think he could take another step.
"You can bunk with me under the wagon if you want to,"
Heifer offered suddenly.
"It ain't fancy, but it's dry. I got my bed laid on some bee-gum logs, and I got a canvas fly to keep the rain out."
Thankfully, Jeff accepted. Even if Heifer did have a face that would stop a clock, Jeff was too tired to care. The cook splashed off into the darkness and returned holding something in his hands under his uniform coat, away from the cold drizzle. He thrust dry clothing toward Jeff.
"Here, kid," he said kindly. "Pull off those wet duds and put these on. They're full of holes, but they're dry. Give me your shoes and wet clothes, and I'll dry 'em out for you by the fire as soon as it quits raining."
Gently he helped Jeff pull off his boots and his sodden trousers.
"Here,"
he said, holding back the tarp that dangled down the side of the commissary wagon.
"Hop in there and crawl between the covers. You'll be snoring in 5 minutes."
Jeff beat even that. He was sound asleep in 3. Next morning he and the cook were up with the birds. The sun came out warm and hot. Feeling better, Jeff helped Heifer with the breakfast. He rustled the firewood, carried water, and did a score of other odd jobs besides. He was clearly the cook's favorite now. The weighty men stayed in camp all day, drying out their wet clothing and their powder caps, doctoring one another's minor wounds and cleaning and overhauling their weapons. Still listening keenly for news of Steele and his Texas reinforcements, Jeff strolled into the shade of a nearby baggage wagon and came upon Hooley Pogue. Hooley was clumsily sewing a white flag of truce into the seat of his worn trousers. Except for his big hat and his boots, he was naked. His wet cotton shirt was draped over a nearby wagon wheel, drying in the sunshine. He had taken off his pants to repair them and was sitting bare-shanked on his saddle. Hooley waved his needle in greeting and smiled, his white teeth flashing in his brown face.
"Howdy. In this army, one patch on the seat of your britches means captain, 2 patches a lieutenant, 3 a bucktail private, that's me."
Gaily he held up the tattered butternut so Jeff could inspect the repairs he had made. Sure enough, there were 3 big patches. Jeff was greeted with respect by the bearded rebel horsemen. They had heard how he had rescued Fields. They seemed so friendly that he almost hated to leave. But all that was keeping him now was news of Steele. He had all the information he needed on Cabell.
He knew Blunt had nothing to fear from the Arkansasers. He decided to stay close to Heifer's commissary wagon. It was the social center of Company H Cherokee Mounted Rifles, and a good place to get information. Everybody knew the cook and came by to banter